The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello, Happy New Year, and welcome to Science Weekly with me, Kevin Fong, on the show this week.
We've known for decades now that the results of clinical trials are being routinely and legally withheld from doctors, and that completely knocks the legs out from underneath our aspirations to practice evidence-based medicine.
Science writer and campaigner Ben Goldacre discusses his quest to make drug companies publish all their drug trial results, the good news and the bad. And The Guardian and Observer Science team join me to discuss some of this week's big stories, including research into supervolcanic eruptions and why geoengineering our way out of any climate crisis may not be so easy. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. First up, we turn to this week's news, and I'm joined in the studio by Observer writer and commissioning editor of the Observer Tech Monthly, Nicola Davis. Hello, Nicola.
Hello, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. And by Guardian science correspondent, Ian Sample.
Hello.
Happy New Year to everybody. Nicola, tell us why this week we understand volcanoes just a little bit better.
Well, so this is a couple of papers that have come out this week, which talk about super volcanoes. So we're talking about volcanoes on a scale that could cause mass devastation, human catastrophe, you know, the sort of thing that great films are made of. And what they've discovered is scientists have been looking at what makes super volcano eruptions happen. So we probably won't be around very long to see one if it did go, but it'd be quite nice to understand more about what triggers supervolcanoes, and they're quite different from normal volcanoes.
So it just gives us a sense of the scale of a supervolcano compared to an ordinary, normal, everyday volcanic eruption.
When everyday volcanic eruption can cause quite a lot of trouble. I mean, Mount St. Helens wasn't exactly a walk in the park. That was pretty devastating. But it's mainly the volume of ash and debris that's spewed out by these things which really defines them as being a supervolcano. And there's a scale which volcanoes are put on that goes sort of from one upwards. It's a logarithmic scale. And 8 on that scale is a supervolcano. So you're spewing out sort of thousands of kilometres cubed of material. So it's sort of huge amounts of material. And when the Yellowstone supervolcano blew before, you know, it covered ash sort of all across North America. So, you know, we're talking huge areas that are affected when these things go off.
And that was that, I mean, I didn't realise for quite a long time, but Yellowstone National Park, this place of great natural beauty, is in fact really built upon the caldera of this giant volcano.
Absolutely. If you go and visit Yellowstone, you're kind of in the heart of a supervolcano, which is enough to give anyone a bit of a tremor when they go there. But it's fascinating, huge place. And of course, it's full of wonderful wildlife and everything. But if you go there, the first thing you notice actually is, you know, it smells. It smells sulfurous. And everywhere you go, it smells, this incredibly strong smell. You can't get it out of your nose for days. It's unbelievable. You're never unaware that you're in a supervolcano.
And to be clear, I mean, supervolcanoes almost doesn't do them justice. Now, these are volcanoes whose maximal eruptions are extinction-level events.
Yeah, I mean, it's been postulated, I'm not sure if it's been confirmed yet, but, for example, the supervolcano Toba in Sumatra, that is thought to have triggered a volcanic winter, or thought by some to have triggered a volcanic winter, as a result of the sulfur gases that were spewed out from that. So, you know, these things have huge global ramifications.
So what do we know now that we didn't know before?
Well, so what we didn't know before was why and how supervolcanoes, like the mechanisms as to how supervolcanic eruptions are different from your, I would say, it's loosely run-of-the-mill volcano. So the normal volcano, you have all this magma building up underground, and it hits a certain volume and it just blows. And, you know, there's warning, you get sort of earth tremors, and these accelerate as you get towards the point. You know, there are signs, external signs as well as ground tremors that give you an indication this thing might blow. But with a supervolcano, you have such huge volumes. I was talking to volcanologist Bill McGuire about this, actually, last week, and we're talking about how you keep such a huge volume of hot magma down there. Why doesn't it blow at much smaller volumes? What's the difference? And what they've discovered is that there are several mechanisms, and they've partly started to answer this. So they think that, for example, in a normal volcano, the surrounding rock is quite cool, so and not able to expand or move. So you've got a very rigid container, essentially, for this magma. So the pressure can't be relieved by the ground moving at all. So it will blow. Whereas the supervolcano, they think that, you know, there's a bit more give in the ground, as it were, so it can expand a bit more. And I think ultimately that the trigger for a supervolcano is this magma that rises to the top a bit like a champagne cork, I'm not sure, something like that. They say a football held underwater will kind of pop up to the surface. And it's sort of a huge amount of magma doing that creates enough pressure of its own accord to blow the stack.
And these things are always given as events that occur on extraordinarily long timescales, even in geological terms. Does this research tell us that they might be more or less frequent than we previously believed?
Well, there's always a bit of a problem with this kind of thing. So people have this idea that, you know, Yellowstone, for example, is overdue. But we only know about three previous super eruptions. That's not a huge amount of data points that we're working with there. I mean, you know, there's no recorded history of a supervolcano, and given the devastation that they caused, that's not entirely, you know, whether there'd be any be left over if one went tomorrow to record it, who knows. So it's all a bit difficult to predict.
So we don't know whether to be more or less worried in light of this research.
I mean, I think if everyone's going to go, you won't have a lot of time to worry about it anyway, so you'll probably...
Brilliant, very, very, very reassuring, Nicola. Thank you
very
much.
Sorry. I mean, there is also this idea that, that, you know, people have this idea about drilling into a supervolcano, you let off steam, but as Bill McGuire told me, he said it's like putting a pin in an elephant's bottom, and that it might actually just make things worse. So I don't think we should try that.
Thanks, Nicola. And to read that article by our own Ian Sample, just go to theguardian.com/science. So following on from supervolcanoes, we're going to talk about man-made eruptions, or at least the idea that you might engineer your own volcano-like effect to control the climate. And so an interesting article this week from The Guardian's Damien Carrington, talking about a study that modelled global rainfall patterns if we used artificial volcanic eruptions and emissions to trigger climate change. And I think this whole area of climate engineering, geoengineering, if you forgive the pun, it is a hot topic. It is for the first time entered the IPCC's report this year with a very caveated acceptance of the possibilities that lie there. There are those who say, look, we've got to investigate all options because it is possible that actually we're not going to manage to come to some political solution that reduces emissions sufficiently to get our hands around climate change. And so it is worth investigating even the barely thinkable. But the guys who are caveating this are saying, look, these are man-made interventions which may affect climate in an unpredictable way and in a heterogeneous way across the globe. So you may be able to predict its local effect, but it may have a devastating effect somewhere else. And in that is couched this, you know, slightly intriguing, slightly terrifying idea that, you know, you have your hands on this global, they call it a global thermostats, you know, but it's actually, that's wrong because that suggests that you can engineer a temperature planet-wide. And actually what it is this sort of slightly chaotic thermostat that gets control of your bit of the neighbourhood and screws everybody else up. Ian, what do you think?
I mean, it's interesting. This study in particular, it chose a pretty severe scenario. I mean, it was, you know, it's what you get quite a lot in science, and especially in climate science, where you say, okay, if the carbon dioxide or greenhouse gas emissions are this much, and pick a high end of predictions, and then we use a high end intervention on geoengineering, like putting, you know, extraordinary amounts of SO2 into the atmosphere, then what are the effects? And so the effects you see from the model are then in keeping with that, and so they seem quite dramatic, that you can get the disparities, the heterogeneity you're talking about, you can get extreme effects, unwanted effects in some places and so on. And so how useful is that actually? Because I don't know how close to a real situation it is. And so I think that's a caution over these kinds of studies in general. But all of this stuff is complicated for the reasons you've been talking about. I mean, surely it's kind of not a great idea to rule things out and say things cannot be on the table. If it turns out you need things like this, it's nice to know they're there. But how do you test them on a meaningful scale? And how do you then get into the idea of having an intervention on a global scale that you can sensibly predict the outcomes of? And when do you stop? I mean, if you carry on with the greenhouse gas emissions as are, and the rate increases, what do you do? Just keep pumping more and more SO2 into the atmosphere to combat
it? Who decides that anyway?
Yeah, who controls it? Where does it happen? I mean, this just seems incredibly risky strategy and of kind of last resort.
There is another element to this which was pointed out to me, which is that these interventions, the scale of them, the logistic required, is actually quite modest. And what it means is that you don't actually quite need international efforts to bring them to bear. It's been suggested to me that an independently wealthy individual could get together enough infrastructure to prosecute one of these things. And that becomes quite scary,
yeah,
really.
Yeah, but when you think about it, we've been independently fiddling with climate change, each and every one of us ourselves, for the last however many years we've been around. So, I mean,
yes, but no one individual built a house or a power station big enough to alter the climate on their own.
You know, a sort of series of power stations, that's not an international decision to do that. You know, these things are...
Yes, but even a string of power stations doesn't have the sort of profound and unpredictable effects that, say, the release of many tons of sulfur dioxide into the atmosphere might have, which I mean, and I'm not sure whether to fully believe it, but I'm told that, you know, a multi-billionaire with a fleet of the appropriate aircraft or the right infrastructures could put enough volume into the atmosphere to do these things. So it becomes a regulation thing, you know.
I think we're getting on the...
Well, the point is
that...
But actually, what you begin to get into is you don't need to invent some fictional Dr. Evil-type character who's hell-bent on destroying the world. What you actually need to invent is this well-meaning but slightly misguided, very wealthy individual, which is pretty risky. Pretty frightening, and there are enough of them around. Yeah, I'm there. Michael Crichton, roll over. Well, anyway. All right, so I think we'll leave volcanic eruptions there, but I strongly suggest you read Damon Carrington's article on this new research. And that's easy to do. You just go to theguardian.com/environment. Now on from survival to sex, and next we turn to Ian Sample's story. Ian, you've been writing this week about the importance of the Y chromosome and how it may not be as close to being defunct as we thought.
Yeah, so this really plays off a talk that was given by a woman called Jennifer Graves some years ago, where she was saying that the Y chromosome is could disintegrate out of existence. And the Y chromosome being, you know, the sort of the chromosome we share, the chromosome, you know, XY, men being XY and being the sort of the keeper of the male genetic material, if you like. And what she was saying at the time was that, well, over millions of years, the Y chromosome has lost more than 90% of its genes. And so if you draw a straight line down to the bottom, you can say, well, in about 5 million years' time, it's just going to be completely disappear. Now, if that happened, it wouldn't mean the end of men. It would just mean that those genes for, you know, all those male factors and most of its sperm production, things like that, would hitchhike on another chromosome. But anyway, it's a kind of an interesting issue that whether the Y would disappear. The Okinawa spiny rat has already lost its Y chromosome and gets by without it fairly well. But anyway, this bit of research, and others have come out and said similar things, it has to be said, where these guys were looking at genetic variation and genetic diversity on Y chromosomes. So they got a bunch of men and they looked at how diverse their Y chromosomes were and how diverse all of their other chromosomes were. And so you've got 22 pairs, you know, other pairs, and then your sex chromosomes on top. And there are a number of reasons genetic diversity of Y chromosomes could be really low, because it is very low. So why is that? Well, one reason could be the kind of what they call the kind of Genghis Khan effect, which is where you have few men having enormous numbers of children. And so although, you know, the population may be roughly male and female, you can have enormous variability of fatherhood among men. And so, you know, Genghis Khan is supposed to account for about 0.5% of all male or all Y chromosomes on the planet now. That would lead to less variation because there's few men passing on a few number of Y chromosomes. Now, what this study did is they sort of do some computer models around this and say, well, could that alone account for why the Y chromosome is so, like, similar among men? And they decide that it can't be, because the disparity you'd have to be between would have to be huge. I mean, you'd have to have something like only one in four men passing on their Y chromosome throughout history, which they feel is pretty extreme, even with characters like Genghis Khan running around 1,000 or so years ago. And so in their models, what comes out is that this must be a consequence of purifying selection, which is where natural selection gets rid of bad mutations. So the thing about the Y chromosome and the reason it's withered so badly is it can't repair itself very well, because unlike with in women, where you have XX and they can swap genes when bad mutations happen, they can repair themselves through recombination. The Y chromosome can't do that. It doesn't have a partner it can very well swap with. It can swap a little bit with the X, but not very much. So it just tends to get shot to pieces by mutations and wither away. Now, what they're saying is that this purifying selection, instead of meaning it's driving the Y chromosome out of existence, it's actually pared it down to the bare essentials. And what you're left with, which is about 27 coding genes, protein coding genes, is that's really the kind of minimum, and that this process of degradation is pretty much ground to a halt now. And so you have the chances that it's diminished, well, it's certainly very diminished compared to what it used to be, but it's not likely to disappear altogether anytime soon.
In some far-flung future where there was no Y chromosome, phenotypically, would you or I notice that? I mean, if those genes were distributed to other chromosomes, would we notice it?
I wouldn't.
Well, you might not, but I mean men in general, Ian.
No, and I think it would have to be pretty advantageous for that to happen. I don't think it's the sort of thing that was sort of going to happen overnight. But as far as I'm aware, I don't think, you know, it would have any dramatic, as you say, phenotypical differences, whether we would look different because of that. I don't think that would be hugely.
And when you give the example, because there is precedent, at least for no male sex chromosome in nature, the spiny rat, you go, there are other examples. Are those examples where there has been a Y chromosome and it has disappeared by the same process, or did they never have one in the first place?
Yeah, it's a process. It's where they've lost their Y chromosome. And it's funny, if you look at another study that came up with a similar idea to this, you know, in support of the Y chromosome's ongoing existence, looked at how many genes have dropped off the Y since the human lineage is split from the lineage that led to old world monkeys about 25 million years ago. And it's one gene that's dropped off the Y chromosome in that period of time. And one of the things that happens is that the genes you're left with on the Y chromosome, if you get mutations in those, it tends to be quite catastrophic for you in terms of it will damage your fertility so much your Y chromosome won't get passed on at all. So it has this effect there that, you know, the ones that are there are going to be preserved, likely.
Thank you, Ian. I feel a little bit more confident about my Y chromosome, at least for now. To read Ian's article on this topic, just visit the best science news site, theguardian.com/science.
On January the 3rd this year, the UK government published its report on the shortcomings in the procurement and the stockpiling of the influenza drug Tamiflu. The authors expressed surprise and concern at their discovery that information is routinely withheld from doctors and researchers, not just about Tamiflu, but in relation to many drugs that are currently prescribed in the United Kingdom. This is something that Ben Goldacre believes is symptomatic of wider failings in the medical industry. Ben, a science writer and author of Bad Pharma, joins me now to discuss his comment piece that he wrote for The Guardian this week, calling for a fundamental change to how drug trial research is handled. Welcome back to the podcast, Ben. Ben, could you first just explain and outline what this report dealt with?
Well, I mean, the interesting thing here is it isn't new information. We've known for decades now that the results of clinical trials are being routinely and legally withheld from doctors, researchers, and patients. And that completely knocks the legs out from underneath our aspirations to practice evidence-based medicine. We can't make informed decisions as doctors and patients if we don't have access to the full methods and results of all the trials that have been conducted on all the uses of all the treatments that are currently available. Now, the Public Accounts Committee did an official review, and this is an extremely influential parliamentary committee. They did a review into the government's £424 million stockpile of Tamiflu. And although the initial remit was just to look at that one drug, when you read the report, they very rapidly broadened out their remit with palpable astonishment into this bigger problem. I mean, essentially, the committee were just baffled and astonished that we have tolerated in the medical profession, the regulatory community and the academic community, that we've tolerated clinical trial results being so casually withheld in such large numbers for so long. So that's really good news.
And can I just ask, I mean, why is it, do you think, that this state of affairs has been tolerated for so long by so many organisations who, in theory, should have been vested in not preserving that status quo?
Well, it's very, very concerning, isn't it? I think there are different explanations at different stages in medical history. It's important to remember that up until the late 1980s, we were actually pretty slapdash in medicine about how we synthesized evidence together. So we do lots and lots of randomized controlled trials on any particular clinical question. Is it worth having antibiotics before an operation? Which of these two treatments for blood pressure is the best? And so on. And then, after doing all those trials, we would allow ourselves to collate the information in a very haphazard fashion. It was only in the late 1980s that we invented the idea of a systematic review, which is a piece of science where you are absolutely rigorous about going out and looking for the evidence, making sure you get all the results from all the trials and putting them all in one place, putting them all in one big spreadsheet, doing something called a meta-analysis, getting an overall summary answer of all of the results. So actually, when you talk to the public about this, which, as you can imagine, I do endlessly, one of the things they're most amazed by is not the outrage and the conspiracy and the bad behaviour by industry. They're more amazed that doctors were so clueless that up until the late 1980s, we were happy to allow ourselves to cherry pick results. Because actually, that makes no sense scientifically. We spend tens of millions of pounds on individual clinical trials. And we spend all that money specifically to try and exclude bias. We spend that money to try and detect often very subtle differences between two different treatments to find out which is the best. And we spend that money because we're not happy to rely on hunches or what we reckon about who's getting better on which treatment from our daily experience in clinic. So it's a peculiar paradox that after spending all of that money specifically to exclude those biases, we then allowed all of those biases to all flood back in at the second crucial phase of the research process, which is collating all of the evidence together in order to get the best overall summary answer. So that's a very long-winded way of saying, up until the late 1980s, I think it's fair to say we had a collective cultural blind spot. We just didn't recognise that it was a problem.
Now that we have recognised this so-called blind spot, what is the solution? And in fact, why have we not arrived there yet? I mean, you've hinted that it's an industry-driven thing, but so why have we failed to see our way around this blind spot?
Well, the core thing that we need, and this is what the All Trials campaign, which I set up a year ago, asks for, is we need the full methods and results of all the trials that have been conducted on all the uses of all the treatments currently available to be in the public domain. Now, practically achieving that is very straightforward, but industry have lobbied very aggressively against it. And it's important to be clear here that clinical trial results being unavailable is a problem both for industry trials and also for academic trials. Independently sponsored, government-sponsored, charitably funded trials are frequently withheld from doctors, researchers and patients as well. But the difference is that it's only industry that have actively campaigned against transparency and actively withheld things on request. So what we've seen over the course of the past couple of years has been astonishing. My book, Bad Pharma, came out in September 2012. When it came out, it was met with appalling denialism. The ABPI gave false reassurance on these incredibly important matters of patient safety. The ABPI is the UK pharmaceutical industry body. They said that the stuff in the book was all historic. They claimed that trials are already posting their results on clinicaltrials.gov, which is simply not true. But there was also denialism from... Well, so we've also, since we set up the campaign, we've also seen sort of very aggressive campaigns against it. For example, Ian Sample's front page in The Guardian a few months ago, we obtained a leaked secret internal memo from FPIA and Pharma, which are the two big European and American pharmaceutical industry representative bodies, in which they talk about their advocacy strategy to campaign against transparency, which includes... in quotes, mobilising patient groups. And that's really seedy. That's the kind of bad behaviour from industry that we expected in the 1980s. You know, patient groups funded by industry, everybody worries, maybe they take industry's side in discussions on policy and treatment. And here is a clear example of industry apparently discussing exploiting that network.
What is it you think the industry are so worried about? What is it that your... demand to have all trials published threatens for them?
It's an interesting question. I think there are two separate issues here. Firstly, industry at present is able to make a good income from producing the second, third, fourth, or fifth best drug in a class. Because you can get people to prescribe it through a combination of badly designed trials, incomplete reporting of trials, and biased dissemination of evidence, which is all that marketing really is. If we had perfect information for doctors, researchers, and patients, then increasingly people would only be prescribing the best treatment in its class. So that would sharpen the rewards. It would mean that for making the best drug in class, if you were lucky enough to be the one company that happened to do that, you would get huge rewards. But it would mean that if you produced second, third, fourth, or fifth best in class, then the rewards would be very modest. People would only use that treatment when people had idiosyncratic side effects or responses to the best drug in class. So I think it's partly that they want to be able to get away with selling the drugs that aren't the best of the currently available drugs. I think if you look back, however, they're also worried about the reputational issue, because the era of trial results that industry is battling most keenly to withhold is the trial results from the past. So we've seen all kinds of proposals for greater transparency from FPIA, the European industry body, Pharma, the American industry body, from European legislators and also from the European Medicines Agency. But all of these new proposals for greater transparency, which are all being promoted as if they are fantastic leaps forward, they all share one common loophole, which is they are all guaranteeing access to trial information from 2014 onwards. Now, the problem with that, as you know, is that we don't prescribe in medicine drugs that came on the market from 2014 onwards. We use the antidepressants, the antihypertensives, the anti-cholesterol drugs, and so on. Everything we use in medicine, it came on the market in the past 5 years, the past 10 years, the past 15 years. And so it's the trial results from that era that we need. So perversely, that actually means that all of the new proposals for transparency, which only get us access to trial information from 2014 onwards, have a loophole which excludes all of the trials relevant to current clinical practice. And that's bizarre. And I think that shows, because industry have been so aggressive about protecting the older trial results from access to patients, I think they are concerned about the reputational consequences and also possibly the litigation risk. And I think they are wrong to have that concern. And this is really important. I mean, anybody working in industry who is listening to this right now, and I've said this to many senior people in industry over the last year, the likelihood of there being a litigation risk is vanishingly small for one simple reason, which is that it's very, very difficult to model the public health impact or the impact on an individual of their previous unethical behaviour. I think it's fairly unusual that there are drugs on the market in widespread use that do more harm than good, right? I think the problem is mainly suboptimal prescribing.
But wait, can I just take you up on that point, Ben? Because, I mean, in reading your material, and I completely understand the thread of the whole argument, but it is tempting to extrapolate backwards and say, how the hell did we ever know that anything that we did in the past was any good, given that this state of affairs or something much worse existed in perpetuity before? I get this sense of, in the period of even my training and my early practice, how did I ever know I was doing any good with any of the drugs that I gave, because the data was so hidden from me, and this was in a time when we weren't even aware that we were dealing with that sort of publication bias?
Well, firstly, we were aware. The first documentary evidence of publication bias was 1986, and there have been dozens of studies since then. It's just that it hasn't had popular purchase, either in the public sphere or really adequate popular purchase in the professional sphere. Your question, how do we know if we were doing any good or not, is a really important one. To be absolutely clear, I do think it's quite uncommon that we use treatments in medicine that do more harm than good. It happens, but I think it's quite unusual. The harm that arises really is from us not giving the best currently available treatment. Commonly espoused implicitly by industry, they're often a bit shy of making this argument too explicitly, but basically people in industry like to say, look, you have to let us get away with doing whatever we want and filling our pockets with gold, because otherwise we will stop innovating, we'll stop producing new medicines. And I think that's a very peculiar argument. Firstly, I have absolutely no problem with capitalism. I have no problem with private investment, and I have no problem per se with industry. There is no medicine without medicines. They produce life-saving products. Actually, it's kind of amazing that the pharmaceutical industry, given that they do produce life-saving products, has managed to trash its own reputation so spectacularly over the course of the last 20 or 30 years, because it is quite a new thing that they've shot themselves in the foot so badly. But I think they're also wrong, because I think you can turn a perfectly good profit, if everybody is playing on an even playing field, being transparent about their trial results. There is no problem with that.
But even if you can turn a perfectly good profit, in the environment in which they operate, if they can't turn the same magnitude of profit, they will be uncompetitive within their own industry. So, for them, I guess, a pretty good profit is not good enough. It's maximizing profits, isn't it? I mean, and that's not, I don't say that in a pejorative sense. They have no option but to succeed in that market. Is that not what's driving this whole thing?
Yeah, so in the current regulatory environment, we reward unethical behavior. We permit people to legally withhold the results of clinical trials. There are two ways of dealing with this. The first, most obvious one, is we change the regulatory environment. We say you have to share the results of all clinical trials, and then it is no longer possible to compete by withholding unflattering trial data, because everybody has to share all of their trial results. And that, I think, is probably the model that most people think is most sensible and most practical. It is perverse that we actively incentivize people to behave unethically with the current regulatory model. We actively incentivize them, as you implicitly say in your question, to withhold trial results, because that allows them to turn a better profit than their competitors within industry. So a level playing field where everybody is transparent is obviously in everybody's interest. And I think that's why it's really great that, for example, a company like GSK, one of the biggest drug companies in the world, certainly the biggest drug company in the UK, have signed up to the All Trials campaign, along with, incidentally, all of the Royal Colleges, faculties, societies, and so on, over 130 patient groups, over 60,000 individuals, lots of people from industry. So GSK have signed up to All Trials, and what's good about that is they are not just saying we're going to be more transparent ourselves, they're also saying we're going to campaign for the whole of industry to become more transparent, because we think it's in everybody's interest that we compete on a level playing field that has ethical ground rules. However, paradoxically, and this wasn't my view a year ago, actually, but paradoxically, I think that having a lot of variation in the marketplace with respect to how transparent companies are could, in fact, create market incentives for greater transparency. And I'll explain why. Basically, I'm saying if Company A and Company B both make drugs which are apparently of equal benefit, but Company A, you can trust their figures, and Company B, you can't trust their figures, then a sensible, safe, and cautious prescriber would choose the drug made by the company with a proven track record of transparency, not because of any kind of political belief. And I don't think we should involve our political beliefs in our treatments of patients, but simply as a matter of safe and effective prescribing. I think it is dangerous, actively dangerous, to prescribe drugs made by companies who campaign against transparency. It really is, because we cannot trust the figures that are produced by companies like that. And so that's why I think, in actual fact, although people campaign, and I campaign, for a level playing field where everybody has to share all their trial results, I think there's going to be some interesting situations over the course of the next few years where doctors, patients, researchers and payers, by which I mean the NHS and health insurers, become more aware of the extent to which some companies' figures in the round can be trusted and some companies' figures in the round cannot be. And I hope that industry will get its house in order before that comes to pass, but I think it is inevitable.
A huge thanks there to Ben Goldacre. You can read Ben's comment piece by going to theguardian.com/commentisfree or by going to his website, that's badscience.net. That's all we have for you on the show this week. We'll be back next Monday. But from me, Kevin Fong, and producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.